Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Things aren't always as they appear, and some bombshells might be hiding in plain sight. I'm Katie Bilotti, and this is Found Objects, a storytelling history podcast. Welcome in, everyone. Welcome back to Found Objects History Podcast with me, Katie Bilotti. I have quite the tale for you today. If you're interested in anything remotely World War II, but also art, you will love this episode because it meshes the two. It's about some heroes that not many people know about, and my boyfriend included, because I actually told him about this and even forced him to watch a documentary about it. And he was shook, for lack of a better word, shook, because, yeah, this is something that not many people know about. Some heroes from World War II that, and I promise, it's not like a super World War II, you know, of course, World War II is a really monumental time in history, lots going on there, but it's not going to be boring, okay? It's not going to be a snore fest, I promise. If you guys like art, you will love this. But before that, I guess personal life updates. As this episode is airing, I will be on my way back to the States. I think I actually will be back. Yeah, the morning that this airs, I will be back and probably severely jet lagged after my trip to Paris. I'm very excited to go to Paris. This is only my second time going to Paris or traveling there. So I'm very excited about it. And I'm sure upon my return, I will have many thoughts and stories to share either here or elsewhere, because you guys know I have a lot of different platforms here on the internet, and I'm trying to figure out where I want to put what in terms of my thoughts. So, yeah, but today, obviously, I'm telling you a story, and I really hope you like this one. I think this will really shock a lot of people. I really do. So, I think without further ado, we just get into it. I think we just do it. So we're going to start out on a bit of a negative note, but I promise it gets a bit better. I promise, okay? But we have to, in order to tell this story, we need to, of course, not sugarcoat what was actually going on during the World War II era. You know, everyone is familiar, I think, at this point, and I'd be concerned if you weren't familiar with Hitler and Nazis, concentration camps, Mein Kampf, you know, the like, all of those things, all of the atrocities of World War II, and just the evil that surrounded this man, Hitler. Not only did he organize the deliberate, systematic annihilation of the Jewish race in a mass genocide referred to as, of course, the Holocaust, he also somehow had the time to organize the looting and mass destruction of timeless art. And that is the realm that we will be in today. So Hitler made it kind of his personal mission, of course, not his only mission, but one of his missions, to create a museum, like a gallery, that was all of his favorite things. He did appreciate art, and we'll get into that more, but he wanted to make and keep all of this, you know, all the priceless art that he deemed beautiful and appropriate. He wanted to steal it and put it in a gallery named after himself. So he stole art, and whatever he deemed not appropriate or ugly, he would destroy. So that was like one of his missions during this time period. And I don't think many people know about this. And the fact that there was a group of people dedicated that risked their lives to save the art. So we'll learn about the missing art and the Monuments Men, which was the group of people that made it their mission to track down the art, or even just prevent it from being stolen in the first place, protecting what was left and, you know, finding what went missing. We'll be talking about the missing pieces of art and the Monuments Men today on Found Objects. Again, something I don't know if many people know about. So in typical found objects, storytelling, style. I want us to imagine ourselves somewhere. I want to put you somewhere, imagine it, really feel like you're there, and that will be where our story begins. You find yourself in an attic, and the sunlight is streaming in through a window, hitting your face, warming your skin and your mind. Before long, the memories start rushing back to you. This attic was your favorite place to escape the chaos and the noise and the commotion of a family-filled day, a busy house. And oftentimes, your grandfather would sneak away to join you in this silent reprieve, this safe, comfortable place, you know, away from all the chaos. The smell of old books and dust fills your nose, just like it did when he would show you his treasures from the past, tucked away pristinely in leather-bound trunks. But that's all just a memory. Now, your grandfather's no longer here. You just feel a ghost of his presence amongst his belongings in this attic. And as you think to yourself, you know, you're having a me moment, lost in thought, kind of thinking back, memories and whatnot, you notice something out of the corner of your eye. There's a little glint of, you know, a shimmer of gold in the corner. And you notice this. You're like, wait, what is that? Like, it's very uncharacteristic for something to be shining. It's only because the sun is coming in at the perfect angle to draw attention to whatever's in this corner, this gold object shimmering in the corner of the room. You inch closer to find out that this gold object that you saw kind of glimmering in the corner was actually an intricately carved golden vase. Upon further inspection of this object, you realize that it's carved with Japanese cherry blossom trees. And that's not all. You also see, next to the vase, a couple of other things. You see some yellowing scrolls. Yes, scrolls. I mean, when's the last time you saw a scroll in this day and age, you know? So you unfurl one of them to take a closer look at what appears to be a hand-drawn map of Okinawa, at least a couple of centuries old by the look and feel of it. You peel back another box and you find more Japanese pottery, ancient, priceless pieces that you've never seen before and you assume are, you know, something special. You just take one look at these kinds of things and you see something deeper, something big, you know, that this is very old, you know? You start unwrapping more and more, your curiosity getting the better of you, and before long, you sit back on your heels and look around you. You're surrounded by countless Japanese artifacts, origins unknown, and you ask yourself, why in the world are these hidden in my grandfather's attic? Well, what if I told you this is actually a true story, guys? A Massachusetts family had to consider this exact scenario. While purging their deceased father's home, they stumbled upon 22 looted artifacts from Japan. With just a quick online search, they were able to figure out that these pieces were part of the FBI's National Stolen Art File. And my first thought, if I stumbled across these things listed on like a stolen artifact website via the FBI, like FBI was in the search bar, I would be freaking out, thinking, oh my God. Well, I'm also just perpetually afraid of breaking rules and breaking laws, even though I'm not one to do that sort of thing. I'm just always afraid I'm doing something wrong. That's just my personality. I'd be freaking out. But this family very calmly was like, you know what, we're going to contact the FBI art crime team and calmly describe what we found. And they soon confirmed that these were in fact stolen pieces of art from the 1945 Battle of Okinawa. So the family worked with the FBI to organize a safe return of the stolen objects to Okinawa via the Smithsonian Institute's Museum of Asian Art in Washington, D.C. And naturally, the governor of the Okinawa Prefecture in Japan was elated by the return of their lost art. But the question remains, how did these stolen pieces end up in the attic of a World War II veteran that was never even stationed in that part of the world? The recent history of these Japanese masterpieces likely died with that Massachusetts man, with the grandfather, and we may never know the truth. On the subject of lost art and war, did you know that there are people who risked their lives to save art before it could be stolen or destroyed? Let's talk about it. First, let's take a little journey, hop, skip, and a jump, over to Europe. In the heart of the Austrian Alps, nestled amongst snow-capped peaks and serene lakes, lies the quaint village of Altasi. But during World War II, this picturesque landscape, this area, became a battleground in the fight for one of humanity's greatest treasures, art. Throughout their reign of terror, the Nazi Party plundered Europe's museums, galleries, and private collections, amassing a vast number of stolen masterpieces. And just one quick Google search, guys, if you Google Nazi stolen artwork online and go to the images, you'll see things on there that are pretty familiar. Even if you're not a super well-versed art snob type, like I appreciate art and I know a lot of art, but it's one of those things where I will look at an art piece, I'll know, like I'll see a painting, for example, and be familiar, like it would be familiar to me, but I wouldn't be able to say, oh, that is painted by this person, like unless it was like a Monet or Van Gogh or something very obvious and familiar, like very familiar. But some of these pieces, you're like, whoa, they stole that? Like they had this. And if you go to the Metropolitan Museum of Art here in New York City, even they have plaques, like plaques next to some of the paintings in the gallery that were stolen. And that being said, there's like a lot of missing information because people don't know like where they were during this time, during certain times, like there's lost records and whatnot. But anyway, so the Nazis plundered a lot of different sources for the art. Like they would steal from people, from private collectors, they would steal from museums, like no one was off limits. But you might be asking yourself, why go through so much trouble to steal so much artwork and then have to find a secure place to hide it? Because of course it was a war, right? It wasn't just like a random day or week or month, it was a war was raging on. So, you know, where would they hide this stuff? How would they hide this stuff? And why did they even care? Well, it's a long story. To put it simply, Nazi leaders sought to control Germany and all of Europe for that matter, we know that, not only politically, but also culturally. And this was summarized in a coordination strategy called, I'm going to try my best with this one, Gleichschaltung. Yep, that's my best German, to sync up the society, politics, and culture in Germany with Nazism. At first, this meant, this like coordination strategy meant ridding Germany of art created during the Weimar Republic, which was 1924 through 1930. And the reason for that, why they wanted to do that, was because art from that time was considered modern art that was, quote, sick and immoral. The regime called this art, quote, degenerate art, and started purging it from Germany as soon as they rose to power in 1933. So like I said earlier, they decided that some art that now would be, you know, it's precious. It's absolutely precious art. Like you can't even really put a price to some of these things. They're so precious and so rare. They just decided they were either ugly, they were immoral, they were whatever, and they just didn't care about it. They either destroyed it or just like did not care about it, let it get destroyed by different, you know, different outside sources. But so this is a direct quote from one of my sources. The Nazis also claimed that the ambiguity of modern art contained Jewish and communist influences that could endanger public security and order. So according to Nazi ideology, only criminal minds could be capable of creating so-called harmful art, which is this modern art. Like they hated modern art. They hated anything created by someone who was Jewish or could have been Jewish or fraternized with Jewish people. Just disgusting that they did this. But this is history. This is the truth. By 1938, the Nazi Party declared that all German museums were clean and completely rid of degenerate art, including all works of Cubism, Expressionism, and Impressionism, to name a few. So those are three huge art movements that they just completely discarded, you know, discarded. And this was back in 1938. So you could probably imagine there's a lot of art we don't even know that was discarded. Like we don't know, the records were destroyed and it's just hard to even keep track of what was destroyed, you know? So this amounted to nearly 16,000 pieces of art that were considered degenerate by them. Then to make sure everyone knew what was, quote, unacceptable, in terms of art, the Nazis allegedly burned over 5,000 works of degenerate art on March 20th, 1939, in the courtyard of the old fire station in Berlin. So they publicly burned, imagine this, like a huge bonfire, and people are chucking gilded framed masterpieces, painted masterpieces, statues and ceramics and all sorts of different mediums of these either Jewish painters or these different movements they didn't agree with, expressionism, impressionism, cubism, modern art, just chucking it into a fire. Just imagine that. Although I will note, it is unclear that this ever happened. There's no legitimate documentation of this burning, but people have referenced it for ever since that it happened. People talk, and it's pretty much known that this happened. So pretty much TLDR at this point, the Nazis have decided certain works of art are not cool, not good, are blasphemous, are illegal. And so they just burned them in a bonfire or just destroyed them in some way. And to further hammer the point home, the state hosted degenerate art exhibitions. Interesting to note, though, the Nazi Party actually auctioned off many pieces of so-called degenerate art for a pretty penny. So funny that they're like, this stuff is bad, it's illegal, but they also were like, let's auction it off and make money. So make it make sense. They were willing to profit off of this. Also, who was buying it? Who was buying the degenerate art? Because in theory, wouldn't purchasing it then make you liable for, you know, going to jail? Like you could be going to jail because of the fact that you own it. Like you couldn't display it, that's for sure. So it's very backwards and very weird. But that being said, you know, it was evident and quite ironic that the Nazis knew how valuable this art was, but they decided it was bad and it was, you know, it was something that could be burned. So the question is, did the Nazis confiscate all of this art because it was in fact corrupt or, you know, degenerate art, like they called it, or because they knew that they could sell it and fund the Nazi Party's escapades? Like they would feel okay with selling it and no one could come for them because, after all, you know, these were either Jewish painters or something that just seemed inappropriate to them. Like, I think it might have been a cover-up, like, or not a cover-up, a cover. Yeah, a cover. Or just a way to be sneaky without anyone, you know, they wanted to raise money, but it's all very backwards to me, guys. All very backwards to me. Make it make sense. I digress. So let's talk about the opposite, the flip side. So we just talked about all the art that Hitler and the Nazis don't like. So these are, you know, Impressionism, Expressionism, Cubism, anything painted by a Jewish painter or someone that knows a Jewish painter, you know, just those are the things that were considered degenerate and illegal. So on the flip side, let's talk about the art that Hitler and the Nazis decided to keep because they liked it, they appreciated it, they saw the value in it. And it, of course, wasn't degenerate, wasn't something that was Impressionism, Expressionism, created by a Jewish painter, anything like that. So the antithesis to degenerate art was, quote, an art that portrayed the Volk and the Volkmanschaft, or the Volk community. And in Hitler's narrow world, Volk signified, quote, the people or a unit of mankind of which the German people was the greatest. He believed that the state existed to serve the Volk, a mission that to him, the Weimar German Republic failed to accomplish. So basically, Hitler wanted new artistic creativity to arise in Germany with the race-conscious arts of Nazi culture replacing degenerate art. According to the Nazis, acceptable and desirable art included old Flemish and Dutch masters, medieval and Renaissance German artworks, Italian Renaissance and Baroque pieces, 18th century French artworks, and 19th century German realist painters depicting German Volk culture. So yeah, a lot of things are probably ringing bells to you just in terms of the fact that everything kind of relates back to being pro-German. The Nazis didn't have pieces of, quote, acceptable art per their own description, so they took it upon themselves to get some. So it started as ridding Germany of degenerate art, you know, shaking Germany upside down, getting rid of all the art that they decided wasn't good, wasn't right, wasn't German. This turned into them going out and stealing priceless works from all over Europe that fit the desired Volk characteristics. So initially they were going through their own turf and now they're venturing out, like I mentioned earlier. So art looting that had begun on an ideological basis became an organized government policy. for Nazi officers seeking social status and promotion within the party, collecting and giving art confirmed one's dedication to promoting Nazi racial ideologies. So it was a way to emulate Hitler and the like. So as you can imagine, this is when the looting began. Once Nazis became aware that, you know, this was something that Hitler wanted, they wanted to please Hitler, they wanted to be more like Hitler, Hitler appreciated art, because I think I might even discuss this later, I actually forget what I wrote down, but Hitler at one point in time, like when he was young, created his own art. And so he had an appreciation for art. Also, he knew the value in it. He knew he could sell it. There was a bunch of different elements here. You know, he's not a good guy, but he appreciated art. And so everyone, all of his followers were like, oh, we want to make Hitler happy. And also it was kind of like, it was a decree. So they had to do it. After long, across Europe, word spread like wildfire that Hitler was after art. So caretakers of the art that was in the categories of things that Hitler was looking for, museum curators, priests, and members of the resistance attempted to hide the art from the Germans to no avail. Time and time again, the Germans found the hidden pieces and stole them. They killed when necessary. If people weren't giving up the art so easily to them, they would kill them. Like, the Nazis had no shame. They would just kill people over this art that they wanted. As the confiscations amassed and more places were being looted, the Nazis had all this art and they didn't know where to put it. Because, of course, like, it's still wartime. They need to hide it and put it somewhere. It's like thousands, like 15,000 plus pieces of artwork. And like, some of these paintings and statues are not small. So they decided to store the collections in Austrian and German salt mines and caves for protection. So yeah, it is what you're imagining. In a cave, in a literal cave, they would put all of these precious artworks. Mines also offered ideal conditions for storing artwork, low temperatures and moderate humidity. So not only was it off the beaten path, people weren't really looking in there, especially during wartime, nothing was really happening in the mines. So they hid things there safely, but also the temperatures were actually ideal for housing artwork. Let's go back to that sleepy village of Altasi that I briefly mentioned earlier. Well, this was one of the lucky locations chosen by Hitler himself to store his collections for his museum. Supposedly, the complex series of tunnels had been mined by the same families for 3,000 years. Inside, the conditions were constant, between 40 and 47 degrees and about 65% humidity, ideal for storing the stolen art. The deepest tunnels in Altasi were more than a mile inside the mountain, safe from enemy bombs, even if this remote location was discovered. The Germans built floors, walls, and shelving, as well as a workshop deep in the chambers. Among the walls of the Altasi salt mines were priceless works by the likes of, listen to this guys, Michelangelo, Rembrandt, and Da Vinci. The artwork sat untouched for years, but as the tides began to turn in the war and it drew to a close, the Allies set their sights on reclaiming what was rightfully theirs. But a lot of the times, guys, they didn't know where it all was. Because, of course, they're in these remote salt mines and just deep underground. How would anyone know that unless they're tipped off? Like, how would they know where to look? Enter the Monuments Men. The Monuments Men were a group of Allied soldiers, art historians, architects, and other field experts who were tasked with protecting cultural treasures during World War II. They represented 13 nations and were 345 men and women strong, according to the Metropolitan Museum of Art. I want to just like paint a picture of this group. So men and women, you know, 13 nations, 345 of them. Most of these people were not fit for war. They were either older, they were not trained, they were not soldiers, right? They came into the war efforts. They entered into this very unsafe territory with the primary focus of, you know, protecting art and identifying art. So that's why a lot of them are art historians, because they could properly identify what was what and know how to treat and take care of the art pieces as they were retrieved. So these people were not, there were some that were soldiers, but not many of them. So they're going into harm's way, into enemy territory to find this artwork. It's really just crazy when you think about it. This group was officially named the Monuments, Fine Arts, and Archives Program, and it was established in 1943 by the Allied forces. Their efforts played a crucial role in safeguarding priceless cultural heritage from destruction during the war. And this being said, there is a great movie that you should watch, homework, after this, called The Monuments Men, that depicts the true story of the Monuments Men with a truly star-studded cast. And it's worth the watch. But more than that, one quote from George Clooney, who actually directed the film. George Clooney, there's Matt Damon's in it, a bunch of different people are in it. George Clooney, what he said in the movie truly embodies the purpose of the Monuments Men as an organization. Quote, "Protect what's left, find what's missing." So that was their goal. That was their motto. They were like, let's try to protect what we can. We're, you know, of course, we're kind of in over our heads and a little bit late to the party. So let's just try to do what we can and find what we can't, what we know is gone. So most of the Monuments Men initially worked alone or in small groups. There were not that many of them, but there were countless pieces to protect and find in the rubble of the warpath. Hence, the best way forward was to, you know, divide and conquer, as people do. They met only occasionally to share their information to avoid a duplication of efforts. So they had like these rough maps. They kind of divided and conquered, like, you two go there, you two go there, whatever, that sort of thing. And we'll meet up just to make sure we're not, you know, sabotaging the other's operation by accident or just doubling the effort when it's not necessary. So the challenge of working in isolation was particularly highlighted by the work of Lieutenant James Rorimer. Rorimer mostly worked alone in Normandy, France, without a vehicle or an assistant, hitching rides on Allied military vehicles and with French civilians. When that wasn't possible, he walked alone. So Lieutenant James Rorimer is one of the Monuments Men that's documented in history, and two more notable members were Major Robert K. Posey and Lieutenant Commander George K. Stout, who arrived in Normandy in July of 1944. And they were two of the 12 Monuments Men who served near the front lines during active combat and were each responsible for large regions in Europe. And these two guys, Major Robert K. Posey and Lieutenant Commander George K. Stout, the ones I just mentioned, they both have art backgrounds. So Stout was an art conservator and was transferred to the Monuments Men in June of 1944 and was tasked with protecting significant cultural artifacts in France. And then Posey, the other guy, was an architect whose main objective was to inspect damaged monuments and make temporary repairs as best as possible. They had no idea that the scope of their looming missions would be so intense, and we will get into that. You see, during his time on the front lines, Major Posey was able to inadvertently gather crucial information about the whereabouts of Hitler's stolen art collections after he came down with a terrible toothache. A toothache, of all things. Posey was referred to a local dentist whose son-in-law happened to be an art scholar. When questioned by Posey, the scholar quickly admitted to working for Hermann Göring, who is Hitler's second-in-command, and helped steal trainloads of valuable artwork. The information the scholar disclosed led Posey, and by default the Allied forces, directly to the salt mines and the caves. Up to that point, they had no idea that that was where Hitler was storing the looted pieces, because like I said, how would they have known that, right? Like, how do you just guess? Like, oh, they're definitely hiding this stuff in the salt mines. Like, they got to the point where they knew what was stolen, and maybe when it was stolen, but they didn't know where Hitler was marching all this stuff out, like where they were hiding the things. And now, because of this guy getting a toothache and getting a tooth pulled, pretty much, he figured it out. Hence, this critical discovery started the initiation of mission, quote, find the salt mines, before the Nazis realized that their hiding spots were no longer secure. So the Nazis didn't have anyone staked out front of the salt mines, like, you know, watching, trying to protect anything. Like, they just didn't even have the smarts to do that. So mission find the salt mines included the Altasi mission, the Altasi tunnels that I talked about. They worried that as soon as the Nazis sniffed out their plan, though, they would burn the contents of the mines. And unfortunately, that was the case for some locations because the Monuments Men could not be in two places at once. There just wasn't that many of them at this time. So, you know, they just kind of hoped for the best, did what they could, right? Like I said, that George Clooney quote, protect what's left, find what's missing. It's like, you know, do what we could. So led by Stout and Posey, a small group of Monuments Men arrived in Altasi on a crisp morning in May of 1945. They would blow out, their breath was visible in the cold mountain air. Equipped with their insider information, their insider knowledge from the toothache incident, their mission was clear: to liberate the hidden cachet, I always have an issue with that word, cachet of artwork rumored to be concealed within the depths of the Altasi salt mine. They were absolutely jazzed and ready to go. After months of searching for a jackpot of this size, like, they had gotten some smaller hauls, but this was, I mean, if it was true, if what they heard from this guy at the dentist was true, they were in for a jackpot. But they were immediately met with a roadblock. The entrances to the mine had been blocked. At first, the team thought that the Nazis had beat them there, but they soon found out that the local miners sabotaged the Nazis because they heard that they intended to destroy everything stored within. A couple of months prior, there was a directive to destroy that came from Hitler himself, and this was called the Nero Decree. It read, quote, "All military transport and communication facilities, industrial establishments, and supply depots, as well as anything else of value within the Reich territory, which could in any way be used by the enemy immediately or within the foreseeable future for the prosecution of the war, will be destroyed." In other words, the monuments men were in a race against the clock because this mine was going to be destroyed. And that's why initially when they pulled up and they saw that it was closed, they were like, oh God, this is like the first phase of them. Maybe they had already destroyed it. Maybe it was completely, you know, caved in because of the Nazis. But it turns out, like I said, that the locals were like, oh crap, we need to, you know, protect our mine. So they covered up, they blocked off the entrance to the mine so the Nazis couldn't come in and put an explosive in there. That was it. So it was kind of a blessing in disguise. But like the townspeople knew what they were doing, but it did pose a problem for the monuments men because they then had to figure out a way to get through that, right? To get in there and get the art out before anything happened. So the monuments men were in a race against the clock because of this. Luckily, Posey, one of the members on this mission from the monuments men, was able to use his architectural engineering knowledge to safely access the mine. Guided by numerous intelligence reports and local informants, the team descended onto the labyrinth of tunnels that wound their way through the mountainside. The air grew thick with anticipation as they pressed forward. Their footsteps echoed off the walls of the ancient mine. But their progress was not without more obstacles. The Nazis had rigged the tunnels with booby traps and hidden dangers, testing the resolve of the monuments men at every turn. Yet they pressed on, driven by a sense of duty and determination to reclaim what had been stolen. Which is just so amazing that they didn't really like fear for their own lives in this. Like, they just wanted to save the art. It's very noble because a lot of them did die in the line of fire. Like, they were killed and tortured for this. So it's very just amazing to read this story. It really is. Anyway, finally, after days of arduous searching, the monuments men stumbled upon the entrance to the hidden chamber. With bated breath, they stepped inside, their eyes widening with wonder at the sight that greeted them. Because again, they didn't know, after all the work, you know, days of trying to get through into the cave, they weren't sure what was going to greet them, right? Like, that this could be a trap. This could be something where the Nazis drew them in to then kill them. You know, there's nothing in there, or there's maybe like two things. After all that work, you know, they were expecting this jackpot and the guy at the dentist told them so. They didn't know what to expect, but they walked in and were amazed. Row upon row of crates stacked floor to ceiling filled the cavernous space, each one containing a priceless treasure of art. 6,577 paintings, 2,300 drawings or watercolors, 954 prints, 137 pieces of sculpture, 129 pieces of arms and armor, 79 baskets of objects, 484 cases of objects thought to be archives, 78 pieces of furniture, 122 tapestries, 1,200 to 1,700 cases, apparently books or similar, and 283 cases, contents completely unknown. So that was what was recorded as being found in this tunnel in Altasi. With meticulous care, the monuments men began the painstaking task of cataloging and safeguarding the artworks, ensuring that each piece would be returned to its rightful owner. And that must have been really tricky. So not only are they just like bringing the artwork back on Allied soil, but they need to figure out who it belongs to and return it. Like, that must have been really tough because a lot of it, how are you going to know who owns, you know, who it belongs to, especially if it's a private collector? Commander Stout originally thought that the removal would take place over a full year, but that changed in June of 1945, when the Allies began to set the zones of post-VE Day. Europe and Altasi seemed destined for Soviet control, meaning that some of Europe's great art treasures could disappear into Joseph Stalin's hands. The Soviets even had trophy brigades whose job was to plunder enemy treasure. So instead, General Stout was faced with a seemingly impossible task: move everything by July 1st. So, mind you, they went into the mine May of 1945. They had to get everything out by July. And that's over 6,500 paintings, 2,300 drawings, like all the things I just listed. That's a lot of stuff to save and catalog, right? So all because of the Soviets, all because the Soviets wanted to steal this stuff. You know, not, they aren't on the side of the Nazis, obviously, but they wanted to get all the treasures for themselves and not return them to their owners. Like, they were going to just, you know, keep them. For days on end, the team worked tirelessly, their hands stained with the dust of centuries-old canvases. A first-hand account from Stout, General Stout, in those sleepless days and nights is as follows. He wrote, quote, loaded less than two trucks by 11:30, he wrote on June 18th. Quote, too slow, need a larger crew. There were always too few hands on deck with the monument's men, too few resources like packing materials, and too few vehicles available for the careful transport of the art. So it's honestly just amazing. Like, I'm just thinking to myself, I just walked through the Met a couple of months ago, most recently, and seeing the plaques of, like, this was seized by Nazis, blah, blah, blah. Like, the fact that these artworks today look so pristine, they aren't, like, you know, so royally messed up because of this time period, because of this, they only had such a short period of time to save all of these artworks from the mines, from the caves. It's just remarkable that they were able to do so well in such a, under all of this pressure with not that many resources. By June 24th, General Stout extended the workday to 4 a.m. to 10 p.m., but the logistics were daunting. So 4 a.m. to 10 p.m., they are, you know, manually, it's like manual labor from that 4 a.m. to 10 p.m., trying to save the art. But the logistics were daunting, communication was difficult, and it rained. All hands grumbling, General Stout wrote. July 1st, as I said, was their deadline for completion of the project. They needed to get it all out of there before the Soviets could come, but they were far from finished. They had heard that the post-Victory in Europe Day boundaries had still not been settled, so Stout and his crew continued. They were like, you know what, things haven't really been figured out after the war. So the crew plowed on. So in the Altasi salt mine were some very notable, very famous artworks from Michelangelo, the Ghent altarpiece, which if you Google that, G-H-E-N-T altarpiece, that's like a very famous, you know, altarpiece. I don't know how else to describe it. Something that goes on an altar at a church, and it's very beautiful. And if you watch the movie, The Monuments Men, you can see what I'm talking about. Like the replicas, obviously, because it's a movie, but there's a bunch of things, the Madonna. On July 19th, Commander Stout reported that 80 truckloads, 1,850 paintings, 1,441 cases of paintings and sculptures, 11 sculptures, 30 pieces of furniture, and 34 large packages of textiles had been removed from the mine. So their efforts were not in vain. As news of their discovery spread, the world rejoiced, celebrating the return of some of history's greatest masterpieces. And amidst the jubilation, the name of Altasi would forever be etched into history, a testament to the bravery and sacrifice of those monuments men and those locals, even, who risked everything to preserve the legacy of art for future generations. So, yeah, like, this is just crazy that they, you know, went from a time when they didn't know where the art even was to locating it in a cave and having to get all of it out of there. Like, it's just, it sounds like a movie. I mean, it is a movie, but it's based on true events. Like, that is just wild. Commander Stout is a name that also would never be forgotten. In his biography, Lincoln Kirstein, another monuments man, said, quote, Stout was the greatest war hero of all time. He actually saved all the art that everybody else talked about. Despite the widespread success of the monuments men, all of the artworks that they saved and risked their lives for, some of them dying for, we know that not everything was salvaged. There are still numerous works that have never been discovered post-World War II and Hitler's reign. So these things, like the intro where I talked about those Japanese artworks being in someone's grandfather's attic, like these things could still be, and likely are, you know, somewhere hidden hidden away, even now. And some of these things, amongst these that were never recovered, is Raphael's portrait of a young man. And this is a very famous painting, a very famous stolen painting everyone knows, or missing, rather, stolen than missing painting. This is one that I saw a photo of it, and I'm like, wow, yes, I know of this. I've heard of this one before. And it was painted in either 1513 or 1514. And it was originally housed at the Czartoryski Museum in Poland. As the Nazis advanced and art looting became expected, like, word traveled at this time, like, you know, when the looting was just about to begin. So Prince Augustin Joseph Czartoryski attempted to save some of the paintings that were in the museum, his namesake museum, of course. He tried to save some of the paintings by taking them from the museum and hiding them away. And Portrait of a Young Man was one of those paintings. He hid them at a remote home, but they were eventually found by the Nazi allies. And then it was later shipped to Berlin to be saved for, of course, Hitler's museum. So to this day, no one knows where it is, which is really spooky. Another famous piece that still evades historians is called An Angel with Titus Features by Rembrandt. There was little known about this piece even before World War II, but it was cataloged as missing during the Nazi invasion of France. And this artwork was kept in a chateau in the French countryside, where it was found by the Nazis and then taken to Paris in 1943. It's believed that then this piece was set aside to become, of course, part of Hitler's frickin' museum. It's well known that Hitler had great respect for the old masters and therefore would have wanted a Rembrandt in his museum. Even though 162 of the pieces that were slated for Hitler's museum were recovered, there has been no sign of many of the others. Perhaps these two paintings and the countless others that went missing will turn up in the most unlikely of places. Maybe, just maybe, and this is honestly a dream of mine, to be at an antique store somewhere and be, or at a Goodwill, imagine, at a Goodwill or something like that, going through paintings and finding these priceless works that have been lost and now are found. It's just, it's crazy because we have no idea where they are, but imagine. Maybe they're in an abandoned home in Germany that is sat untouched since the war, overgrown with brush and crumbled exterior, and we just don't know where these pieces are. They could have been burned also. We don't know that either, but I would hope not. So they could be really anywhere. They could even be in an attic in Massachusetts, for all we know. So guys, that is the story of the very brave Monuments Men and how they were able to save a lot of artwork during World War II, saving it from the destruction by the Nazis and Hitler, or just any number of things that could have happened to them, really just saving them from the unknown and getting them back to where they needed to be, back to the owners in most cases, back to the museums. And you can see a lot of them on display even today, luckily, because of these people, because of these men. That would not be possible. They would still be, you know, they would be burned, they would be in some mine somewhere or owned by some private collector that did not deserve to own it. You know, there many things could have happened to these paintings and these sculptures and furniture pieces and all of the above, if not for the Monuments Men. And I highly recommend you guys watch the movie if you are interested in this. It really just paints a better picture and it shows visuals. But of course, I will also have a little visual display over on our Instagram Found Objects podcast, so you guys can see what I'm talking about visually. So thank you guys for listening. I really appreciate you. If you have a second, give us a 5-star review. Let me know what you guys think over on the Instagram post. Drop us a comment. And remember, guys, things aren't always as they appear. Goodbye. This episode was produced, edited, and told by Katie Bellotti. Research by Sarah Schilling. Podcast artwork by Siri Devlin. Follow us on Instagram at Found Objects Podcast. Tune in next Wednesday for a new episode. Goodbye.
Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
My dad works in B2B marketing. He came by my school for career day and said he was a big ROAS man.
Then he told everyone how much he loved calculating his return on ad spend. My friends still laugh at me to this day.
Not everyone gets B2B, but with LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people who do. Get a $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/results to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/results. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be.